So the first two shows we're looking at are Nan Goldin at Matthew Marks and Jim Lambie at Anton Kern. Great. Well, Nan Goldin, I have to confess, co-panelists, that among the things that I like, that I love to look at, are paintings in the Louvre and pretty young lesbians. So, consequently, Nan Goldin and I feel like we're on the same page to some extent. Scopophilia, in a way, it's a beautiful, well, it is a beautiful word. I mean, we all love to look, and yet, of course, the term also has psychological connotations that are akin, perhaps, to narcissism or voyeurism or some combination thereof, and which perhaps we, at least publicly, prefer to distance ourselves from. What are we left with, or what do we get from Nan Goldin, Ara?
Well, two of the words that I would always use to describe her work, you've already hit on the head, narcissism and voyeurism, and we get that in spades. I'll confess that walking into the show, I was prepared to wield those terms against her work, which I've always found to be sort of the visual equivalent of a kind of whiny Jewish girl from Massachusetts with a lot of privilege and a lot of time on her hands. She's most famous, of course, for her photographs in the 90s, which came out in a collection called The Ballad of Sexual Dependency, which essentially document in an almost glamorous way the kind of down and out bohemian scene of drug addicts and sort of the fringes of the art world. And interestingly and fittingly enough, the slideshow that is included in the show is dedicated to Peter Huger and David von Rovich, both of whom were, in addition to being lovers, famous artists in the New York 80s and 90s art scenes, both of whom died of AIDS, and with whom she was quite close. So all of that said, I was prepared to find the usual stuff. What I found personally was, in addition to this video, which rehearses, as you've seen, a lot of these, what amounted in some cases to a kind of, reminded me at least of a kind of art history class of comparisons. Mm-hmm. But the premise of the show, for those of you who don't know it, is that she was inside the Louvre relatively recently when it was closed to the public and was thus able to see its collection essentially for herself, a privilege for which all of us would be obviously eminently grateful, and which she repays in obviously loving framing of various works from Pontormo to Delacroix. What is, I think, supposed to be kind of the revelatory and, as you put it, with the kind of portentous Monteverdi piping in the background, aha, a revelation of the show, is that, lo and behold, so many of her own works from the past, even in their casual, offhand way, are formally reminiscent of these great poses from the history of art. And while visually stimulating and even fascinating as those comparisons turn out to be, it's not, in the end, to me, anything terribly profound. In the end, it amounts to what I think is essentially the same kind of navel-gazily self-indulgence to which her work has long kind of, in which it's long indulged. So
right.
Visually and brilliantly rich, exuberant, but pretty much the same stuff for me.
Yes, Karen, maybe another lesson to be learned from it, though, is apart from the coincidence or affinity between her photographs and the old masters in the sense that her photographs have old masterly poses, is I looked at it somewhat the other way around, that she was saying it's not just me that is fascinated by a kind of secret history. There's a sort of secret history in the paintings in the Louvre that even if they have mythological or religious subjects ostensibly, underneath they are, like my photographs, a celebration of very special friendships between very beautiful people.
Well, wasn't that sort of, how do I say this? I mean, I noticed that she was taking these famous and amazing paintings and sort of focusing in and framing in on the genitalia, right, and on the sexy bits. And I thought, wow, you know, you're really, she's not showing the entire image, but just honing in on certain parts, which I think might skew the story quite a bit. The other thing I was wondering about when I saw the show is I was wondering, with this comparative motif that she sets up, if she's trying to imply that she too is one of the greats who belongs in the Louvre.
Mm, yes.
What do you think?
Well, yes. I remember David. Do I think she belongs in the Louvre, or do I think
she's implying
it? Yes. I read a biography once of a very famous actress who was on her honeymoon in Paris, and her husband was an even more famous actor, and they were looking up at the Louvre at night, and he was saying, I wonder if we could. And sure enough, he made some phone calls, and they were admitted late at night into the Louvre. So, yes, celebrities in the Louvre.
Is this for me?
That's for you to run with.
Well, it certainly grates a little bit the inherent comparison of our you know, one of our great contemporary artists being set up by the situation of greatness that being represented by a great gallery and being shown in great institutions and then being given this great opportunity to go into the Louvre and take photographs, but she says in the voiceover in the slideshow something about it was the most profound experience of ecstasy of her life to be alone in the Louvre. And this is a photographer who's famous for documenting states of ecstasy, sexual, drug-induced, just sheer self-performative, narcissistic self-love. And the tragic aftermaths of those situations, and that's legitimate, and she has legitimately, broadened the scope of photography, so much so that her audience now is not the people in this room or might be listening to this podcast. Her audience is 18-year-old, alternatively sexualized or alternatively gendered or alternatively just behavioral, kids who see in her work a validation of their lifestyle and an aestheticization of her lifestyle. I mean, her work began also not for an art world audience, but for the people that she was documenting. They were slideshows, literally, for her friends. Mm-hmm. And, something happened out of that reinvented photography, and we have to give her credit for that. Mm-hmm. However, her great talent is not for documenting eternally still marble, cold, oil-painted things on the wall. Her talent is for documenting the entanglements of life around her. And there is ample evidence of some new photography that's in the slideshow, particularly moving photographs of her lovers and her friends. But we don't see the tragic part of the scope anymore. She's now successful. She's gone through rehab. What does that mean to us? I mean, that's something we should all think about. Was the voyeuristic aspect of her work the most important aspect? Now that she's sober and stable, is it really interesting looking at these nice men in their nice gardens in Italy or wherever they are, or these pretty girls dressing up in these gilded rooms ready to go out to a nice party? That interests me. I have to confess, that interests me less, and probably interests most people less.
But on the other hand, from what you say, there's a few positive things to be drawn, and also a few ethical caveats to your argument. I mean, first of all, how wonderful it would be to get 18-year-old punks to go into the Louvre and to the Met. So I jump with joy at the thought finding a new constituency.
Can I develop on my thought of that?
Yeah.
The reason I brought that up was that what you brought up earlier about the hidden history in the Louvre of transgender, bisexual love, gay love, every category, hermaphroditism of every interior category between masculine and feminine, that's there right in plain sight. It's rife in the middle of neoclassicism, in the middle of the revolution when masculinity was being preached in classical painting. It's even, why is that there? A lot of people who will be seeing this show will be surprised to see that.
But it seems to me, I agree with your points, but it seems to me also that so much of if we want to put it in simple terms, the identity politics of what might be rescued from that of hermaphroditism is also offered up in a very sort of coldly formal way, often a beautiful way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what you were saying earlier is to the point, to the extent that these objects are as much the site of kind of formal reflection and delectation as they are for the meaning of their alternative kind of histories. And something that David said earlier actually helped me think about it in a different way, which is that not necessarily that if we might look at these comparisons that she set up, not as a way to necessarily exalt her own work, that is to bring it up to the high level of the great masters, but also to bring down, in a sense, a painting by Courbet or Pontormo to the original, actually, personal histories of the model that they might have. They're now sort of rendered timeless artifacts for us, right? Mm-hmm. But that, you might think of it as kind of the girl with the pearl earring moment,
yes,
in which these works are kind of brought back to a human dimension. To that extent, I think you're right. I appreciate that element of it.
Karen, do you retrieve... yes, she focuses on the body parts. In fact,
yes,
she kind of cheats and crosses the Seine to go to the to Dorsay in order to... The Origine du Monde actually hangs there. So enamored is she by what's actually a very minor Courbet painting, but a sensational one, that she'll... She bought it in the Louvre. She went to the Musée d'Orsay. But that piece of trivia notwithstanding, do you think she could bring a new constituency to a love of old masters or an intrigue in the old masters?
They'd have to go to Matthew Marks and then get on a plane and go to the Louvre. I have to say, and this is partly in response to what David, as I think, said about...
You better use surnames for this end of the table, otherwise... It's Brody or Cohen.
Mr. Brody said about the sort of ecstatic moment that she had when she was in the Louvre. I have to say, I was ready to be sort of cynical and annoyed and jaded by, the sort of self-indulgent character of her work. And I found myself actually believing her when she said that she was just overwhelmed. I don't know if it was the most ecstasy she's ever experienced, but that it was that she just was overwhelmed by the beauty of the moment, of the experience of being alone with these great works and having this kind of privileged access, that they came alive for her in a way that they don't normally do. And that she was then just a lover of images, which can be one meaning of scopophilia, not necessarily of dirty images, but just a feasting your eyes on images. And I actually found myself, maybe it was the Monteverdi I found myself kind of persuaded that she was being honest about that. And I let myself sort of try to feel her excitement there, except I then was annoyed that the images were always cropped in on the nipple or something.
Yeah, I've never personally. I don't have any problem with self-indulgence if it yields a result that's for me an indulgence as well. And I've never been in any doubt about her earnestness. Sometimes I've wished that the volume could be turned down a little on the earnestness. But in fact, no. I David, I um, I felt it was a genuine. If you've gone through, the other point is that if you have gone through rehab, it's a terrible message to give out to say that the ecstasy of looking at great paintings is never going to be as good as the ecstasy of ecstasy, because in chemical terms, yeah, maybe, but in spiritual terms, hopefully, there is some positive and earnest message.
I can completely agree that, the raft of the Medusa is better than a cocaine-fueled orgasm. I mean, I haven't really had recently, I have to compare. But, it's interesting, she didn't seem to have shot in the Grand Salon. I don't recall any images from there. Maybe she was not given access, but in the vein of giving access, I guess the show that I would have wanted to see was for her to be given access to the museum without supervision and be allowed to bring her friends in.
Yeah, party there a bit.
Yeah. Have a party, have sex on the hermaphrodite.
Right.
I mean, that would be the way to do it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you can't convey ecstasy by photography, by photographing something that's already aestheticized. I mean, all she does is she crops it this way, she lights it harshly, she puts them in grids, she fragments them, and it just looks desperate. I don't get any kind of what you'd want there. Really, is super cool photography, the kind of thing that Thomas Struth and Tim Davis or Sherry Levine do. And then you could make these comparisons between the super crisp opticality of French salon painting and maybe her blurry, available light snapshots, or the other way around, with super, Delacroix's kind of painterly stuff and very cleanly lit interior stuff. I mean, there could be all kinds of games you could play aesthetically, and then there's a whole issue of the mythology that we could get into, and probably people know more about that than me, so I'll move on.
I'd like to use the remainder of our time on Golden to think about format, because it seemed to me a problem. I mean, I actually enjoyed this show. I liked the imagery, and I liked the feeling behind them. But I found myself troubled on two counts. One was the sort of merchant ivoriness of the slideshow.
I liked the good production value.
Uh-huh.
That's going to come up later, I think, in our talk when we have someone with poor production values.
Oh, okay.
I sort of appreciated that she took some time and money.
Oh, no. I don't have any problem with the fact that it was done well. It was just that the sort of soft message. With more emphasis on the soft than the porn. And the other thing, though, was that, in that semicircular room with the mustard-colored walls, I thought that was rather gorgeous, the different scales of those. There's been some real sort of intelligent sort of interior decor thought in that presentation, whereas in the rest of the show, I was bewildered that an artist of her stature should do something that's like a very kind of cheesy 70s way of... Because it's not... Because the twin images, old and new, was a very, maybe a banal, but very forceful leitmotif. But those sort of montages, which are not really montages, just it looked like a sort of economy job on framing, where you print six or eight images. Would somebody like to speak up for those and say I'm wrong and it's something useful?
No, I mean, I thought of Dalí's famous collage of close-ups. Formally, they look... But of course, the quaintness of the Dalí is that it is a collage, it is a mock-up, it is, you can tell that it's been in cotton repasted, and I think you're right that as you said, it's sort of saving money on framing, or I don't know what it was, it looked rather...
Especially when we've seen most of the images in the slideshow. Why not?
I don't think Matthew Marks would spare money on framing. I mean, that's not the issue here. The issue is if they could make separate pieces of those and sell them each individually, then they would do that. But I think there's a logic to having for trying this format in which, her best work is sequential montages. So can you make something that's on, a wall piece that works that way? Well, okay. There's one with... called Hair, and they're all shots of hair. Great. There's one with back, they're all shots of backs. Great. But there was one that was called Crazy Scary, And there were 9 images. The first 8, reading left to right, were, Louvre artworks, and the last one was, and they were all of painful, forbidding death, mm-hmm. or some kind of transcendent version of death. And the last one was one of her shots of what looked like a friend dying in a hospital, probably holding out. You just see 2 hands touching, and it's probably someone dying of AIDS. And so that piece is affecting. It can't not be affecting. So there is, I think, there's potential in the project.
I have to say, I didn't even spend much time looking at the images on the walls because I thought it was just a desperate way to try to take the slideshow and turn it into something that you could hang mm-hmm. in the rest of the gallery. I didn't really even take them very seriously. I thought to myself that the slideshow was the work and that the pieces hanging were absolutely secondary and maybe just there so that they could be sold or something.
Yeah, I too was left wondering whether or not the work were essentially kind of film stills yeah. from the video, or whether the video was kind of an explanatory extra to the works. And I think that that was, I tend to think it was the former, that the video was essentially the main the work. Shot.
That was the.
And can I make one more comment too? Why the slideshow works so much better? Because,
sorry, no. I'm sorry. Actually, we can't. Thanks. Come on.
I'm sorry. Just quickly to say that the issue of the music in the slideshow has come up, and it is extremely important, that music. And you don't get that in the works on the wall. And there's a composer who composed that music, actually, for the piece.
Yes, there's a soundtrack.
In earlier works, she's appropriated work or borrowed work. Music, as far as I know. There are other credits in the slideshow that include editor and this mm-hmm. and that and the other thing. So these are collaborative works like cinema. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the effect is collaborative between the different art forms. And, it is hard not to get into a certain mood when listening to Monteverdi-like or Mahler-like music.
Right. No, they were Monteverdi and Mahler.
They were, in fact?
There's a composer who did the incidental music.
Ah.
But then they also had, they began with a chunk of, I think it's the Coronation of Poppea, and then in the middle there was some medieval music, and towards the end there was a setting from, I think, one of the song cycles.
And there's some rather lush romantic piano music. Mm. Was that the Mahler, or was that?
I'm ashamed to admit, I think it was Ravel or somebody.
Okay, well, very
or
good.
Or maybe somebody else.
Thanks for clarifying that.
Okay.
But the music is important.
Music is gorgeous. I felt it was like being in a cinema where you got the movie, and then in the corridor you've got stills, and so I mean, it seems for somebody photography already has the potential problem. I'm not going to open a big can of worms here, but I mean, photography has that borderline something that can be exploited positively or not, but it has that basic problem of being an applied art and a fine art potentially at the same time. So to me it seems very, very odd that somebody who's clearly on the fine art side of it would risk make that sort of ontological risk, if that's, I'm going to use that word, because you've got when you've got stills and you've got the same images appearing in the slideshow, it's got to detract from one or the other to have them both.
Don't you think it's just an economic issue, that it's something that you can sell?
Why not just have them for sale at the back or something, I don't know, maybe.
So we should assume, though, that she's making an artistic statement.
I think we have to assume she is, and even if she isn't.
Well, I think in terms of format, the room with the comparisons between the portraits
yes.
was fun, and it worked as an installation, and it worked in a different way than it would work in a slideshow. And I enjoyed it. I don't think it was particularly profound, but it is interesting to see these morphological, maybe characterological continuities between eras, and to see that we're all sort of being reincarnated all the time, and culture is being reincarnated all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I think it's time to move to Lambie. And look, the lady made what's actually been made very, very often as a very sensible, practical suggestion. Let's look at the images again. And I'm afraid I'm a kind of obstinate mule on this one. We've been to see the shows. The PowerPoint gives us a reminder. And from there on, criticism has to go back to its original task, which is to describe ekphrasis. So if you need the projection a second time, we are failing as critics. Because our job is to generate a discussion that brings to the mind's eye everything that's being talked about. So with that in mind, let's be a little more ekphrastic, co-panelists, in how we tackle Jim Lambie. So, Karen, I read that Jim has a background as a rock musician.
Yes.
And yet, when I saw this show, I thought, gosh, this guy has a very art world background.
Why would you say that?
Well,
Photographs of rock musicians.
Yes, there were. But there were zips and there were targets.
Yes.
And so when I see zips and the targets, I think, aha, Art History 101.
Yes.
What do you make of Jim Lambie? Rock star or art historian?
Can
one be both?
Mr. Cohen, I struggle with Jim Lambie. I think it was an uneven show. I think some pieces were more successful than others. Mm-hmm. One of the sort of things that wasn't immediately apparent to me is that there's a kind of similarity between, I don't think it's clear from the images, it couldn't be, but the concentric circles that are brightly colored are actually regressing into the wall as this sort of conical shape that's about 8 inches deep. And it's placed above the faces of, in one case, I think, Keith Richards and Mick Jagger. And I actually overheard what I think was an art dealer explaining to a potential client that really it wouldn't be too difficult to buy one and install it in your apartment. And you just have to use a little drywall and you could like get this fake wall. But there's actually a similarity between those conical regressing concentric circles and the folded over corner pieces in that they both involve this kind of concavity and this layering of bright colors, right? But I think the large wall piece that he did that's called something like Sunspot Orchid or something that has it takes up a whole wall and it's mirrored and it has these folded in corners is sort of interesting and effective. But I have to say, the balled up brightly colored T-shirts and the old pickle jars that's in the corner, I just felt like I was in the Gap. You know, I thought this would be a good designy kind of commercial thing for a T-shirt store, and then the rolled up belt buckles. Again, it felt very commercial to me, and I just didn't know where I was.
Well, Ara, presumably he is playing very consciously with a pop aesthetic, with the pieces that Karen is distressed by. Would you like to make a case for them?
I agree with the assessment that this is a very uneven show. I think both in terms of medium, material, color, we had everything from folded large metal slabs arranged along one wall with a giant sculpture essentially wrought out of concrete into which were inserted a flattened suit of armor disarticulated and re-embedded in slabs of concrete next to an assembly of cast chairs into which concrete slabs have set and onto which one of these giant belts, metal belts and belt buckle has
non-functional
been set.
Belts. Right, yeah.
Unless you're very big.
There is a degree of kind of pop. You had the very kind of, in its inflated scale, you think of Oldenburg, the belt left me absolutely. I had no idea what to think of it until actually one of the gallery assistants told me that. Well, he's a rock and roll guy, and what's most important thing for a rocker is his belt. And this was news to me that there was a connection between the rock and roll.
Because if you're a rocker, you have to belt it out.
Yeah,
you have to belt it out. Yes.
But is it because you is it because you have to hang your guitar on the belt, or is it because you is there something kinky that goes on with the belt? What is why a belt's important to rock and roll?
The thing that I don't get about those belts is that they're like disco era belts. They're shiny. You know, the big one is got kind of glitter and it's a shiny resin.
The Dylan on the wall is that era, right?
No, it's not, is it? I mean, that the one under the Dylan piece, which technically they're separate pieces, but they're installed as if they're the same piece. Is it seems to me that's a 1980, maybe 1978 faux leather belt, and the Dylan shot is from 1965, and he's wearing kind of raggedy clothes, and if he was wearing a belt, it would be real leather, and the Mick and Keith one also there's a belt underneath that one, and that's that photo is from like Sticky Fingers is 71, and the belt is just a completely different era. Both of those guys might have worn that kind of belt at some point in their,
It may be that your intimacy with the archaeology of fashion and rock is more nuanced than his.
It might be that it's also different in Glasgow. I don't know. I mean, and for his generation. Okay, so he comes up and he's a rocker, but those Dylan and the Stones are already, he's younger than me. The Dylan Stones are already kind of ancient history. And maybe it's all getting mixed up there. And I think that the essential message of his work and of this show is, hey, let's, art, there's a kind of a politics of fun about this work. I think he is political in a way. And I do remember seeing the first tape floor installations in New York, whenever that was, like mid-90s or something like that. And I just had this sense of incredible joy. And it was like, here's someone like Richard Long, but with a sense of fun, with a sense of joy. And he goes, instead of going out to the frozen wastelands of eternal time, he's going into a gallery in the middle of an urban situation, inside of a room, inside of a culture, and he's doing, something like that. And so I think that his instincts are really strong, and I think he does have a message that he wants to give. And maybe he's tried a lot of different things that not everything works. The belts for me, in and of themselves, the rolled-up ones, they do have this kind of, the titles refer to records, and they look like old LPs in a way that you can almost pull them out and play the music. And it's kind of stored inside there. And the vortexes, I think, are supposed to work in a similar way.
They rhyme visually, right? The belts are coiled, and they protrude, and the vortices are concave.
And then you're looking at the vortice, the one of those vortexes, and the colors just draw you in the way that maybe when you were 15 and smoking bongs and listening to a record, you might have been looking at this LP, at least me, and you might have been looking at this LP and being drawn into this, into the landscape of the music, And that's I think that's he wants to find a way to bridge these two worlds, the visual and the ecstatic dancing party thing. I think that also applies to the Sun Orchid piece, the large wall piece, which is very elegant in certain ways, and it looks like a flower. It looks like a series of flowers. It has that same kind of Warhol, Ellsworth Kelly, Morris Louis kind of pure pigment as substance equals flowers. Isn't life beautiful?
Well, and I like that the vortices are actually accidentally created by the four corners, because there are these squares with the corners put in, and then they're stacked next to each other. So then there's a hole where all the four corners would have met, but they're all turned in going the other way.
And the last layer is white, so it goes right into the wall, and it's really quite beautiful, actually.
Yeah.
But I still feel that, then the major surface is mirror, and so you sort of feel like, well, maybe this should be, it's kind of, it feels inert in that space. It would be great in a club.
Yeah.
And I just want to point out one thing. I did Google Sun Orchid because I wasn't sure if it was a real flower. And it turns out to refer to this Sun Orchid elixir that crops up in some Edgar Rice Burroughs tetralogy about some planet. And the elixir is a very rare substance that's fought over. I mean, wars are fought over this thing because one draft of this will arrest the aging process. So that is part of the message of the party, the party message, maybe the slightly tragic message of dressing up in these shiny belts and all of that.
All right. So there's a occult connector between Golden and Lambie, perhaps. I think it's a good moment to bring in our audience to get some comment on the two shows that we've opened with. Karen is the lady with the roving mic. Please wait for it so that we can definitely all hear you and also record you for posterity. But don't feel inhibited by that.
I felt in Nan Golden's work formerly emotional, and this work is more psychological. I'd just like to hear your thoughts about the difference between emotion and psychology.
I'm not sure what you mean by that distinction. Could you elaborate a little bit?
For me, it's very distinct.
Okay.
Something that activates brain activity versus heart-centered.
Okay. Yes, actually, Sanford Schwartz, I was just reading his review of de Kooning on the train coming here, and he opens with precisely that distinction between the psychological and the emotional, which struck me as odd, because I must say I've always kind of put them together. But do others share a strong dichotomy of the emotional and the psychological, which could have bearings on Golden?
Well, I would just point out that there are quite a few images of the story of Cupid and Psyche, and that's a love story, a requited love story, unlike some of the other ones that of myths that she cites, like Narcissus and Tiresias. I don't know. That was an unrequited one. But anyway, she talks about unrequited love, and but Psyche and Cupid end up together. They're married in heaven. So why? I don't really know the etymology, but the word psyche refers to the mind, and yet this is a love story. So what is that about?
Psyche's soul, yeah.
Is that right? Psyche's soul, yes.
Why do we use it to refer to the mind now?
Because
malapropism.
That's all?
I think it's sort of migrated in terminology. I mean, Heraclitus even uses psyche. Psyche essentially means...
It also means like breath in ancient Greek. Yeah. It's your the life.
Well, it might be worth thinking about why it has migrated. It's migrated across this barrier.
But actually, when psychologists talk psyche, they're not talking about the brain, they're talking about the mind. Mm-hmm. And so brain-mind would also then map to the distinction. So, but yes, emotion, viscerality, etc. I think we can get, even though we do have two philosophers and two amateur philosophers on the panel, we might want to not go too deep there. But... and Psyche and Amor do have a difficult moment in their relationship when somebody pours some wax over somebody's chest, which is possibly something for Golden to pursue in the next installment. More comments, please, on either show, but let's start with, either show.
Well, to me, the Nan Golden show was having to do a lot with these archetypal things, you know, that almost like Rembrandt, like you knew that person. Mm-hmm. And then Nan Golden picture was almost like, oh, it's still around, you know, it's still alive today. And that's what it reinforced for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really torn on the one hand by the insight that I think she was asking us to have, which is that there's a kind of timelessness to human experience, to human love interest, to our love of looking at prurient things, our fascination with the naked female form, et cetera, et cetera. And I, you know, part of me wants to agree with her and have this kind of humanist moment of yes, there is a timelessness here. And part of me was very nervous about making that jump from these decontextualized works, right, and having them cropped in on just certain parts of these paintings, to the implicit message that this is all just sort of looking at naked people embracing and such. I find myself also wanting to say no. You know, maybe, you know, what Nan Golden is up to when in her photographs of her naked friends and lovers is not necessarily essentially the same thing as what these painters were doing. And I enjoy that tension between the kind of insight into our kind of common humanity across time and my desire to also be very cautious about making that leap.
Yes, just next to you. Can you use the mic?
I would tend to agree with you in the sense that her own portraits seemed very, very, the people were very specific, and you seemed to make eye contact with the people, and in that way they were very contemporary. Whereas the images that she chose were idealized and not specific. So it seemed like it was a contrast very much with our time and other things in history.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. No, that's convincing. Yes. Good. Some more comments on either show? Perhaps, yes. Please wait for the mic, if you wouldn't mind. Thanks.
Karen, you said that they were T-shirts in the jars?
That's my understanding, is that they are T-shirts.
I didn't know that. I thought that they were underwear.
Well,
and
what
so
does
that makes a lot that makes a lot of sense for that. I mean, that's why, you know, the Hanes underwear, the striped underwear that you buy, and I thought those were all underwears.
T-shirts.
Yeah, that's strange.
I did kind of wonder when I first saw them if they might be not only underwear but dirty underwear, thinking that it was. I mean, he has these you know, Fontana one-liner pieces. So why not a Manzoni one-liner piece? That's kind of seemed like where it was going. But then you realize that the rest of his aesthetic is pretty clean and shiny, so I figured they're clean.
Yes. Yes. You've seen the show, buy the T-shirt. Yes, lady in the front, please wait for the mic if you would.
One thought I had when I was looking at Nan Golden's work is that there's a certain amount of, I guess the word might be commoditization, where when she's taking these works and she's making reference to them, she's essentially being a repackager. I mean, we sort of accept appropriation and all these other things, but in a way, she's using it more like a commodity. You know, that you can buy a box of Kleenex or something and then use it as Kleenex, and it's sort of the original thing. There's no consideration in a way. So I wondered what your thoughts were about that.
A commodity, making a commodity out of these art, out of these works?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the word that's come out is decontextualization. That they are, I think, commodity is right to the extent that they've been reduced to things that can be simply exchanged one for the other. Whereas each one has been ripped out of a history in which it's embedded, and thereby essentially become a vehicle of kind of casual formal comparison. To the extent that commodity, I mean, to the extent that these are actually now photographs that are commodities of original works, they are literal commodities, right? She's rendered them sort of things to be, they're reproductions now. And that perhaps opens up another kind of aesthetic can of worms. But I don't know if anyone else, I mean, I'm not sure.
I would use appropriation rather than commodity. It's appropriative.
Yes, I don't think as a result of them we can run out and buy a Pontormo. So I mean, I therefore don't really see how it's a commodification, other than perhaps that it renders it equal. I mean, the camera equalizes the different painterly textures over the centuries as pretty faces, pretty bodies. I mean, she made Rembrandt's Titus look like an Elizabeth Payton, because it's a game, you know, it is about doomed youth rather than, well, of course, Titus was a doomed youth, but Rembrandt didn't know it when he painted it, but perhaps he did.
As for commodification, I mean, I would think the bigger issue is she commodifying, you know, the sufferings of her friends at times.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Or as I suggested, merchant ivorizing them somewhat. But that's to detract from, she's an artist who has a very distinct palette and mood, and it's a very beautiful one, I think. It's very elegiac, and it's very rare for an artist in any medium to achieve just that amount of intense, meaningful style. So I've got to take my hat off to her and say she gives me some pleasure.
Well, she took a lot of formal and artistic risks in this show, and that's all to the good. And some good things came out of it. So let's give her the keys to some other places.
What formal risks do you see having been taken? I found it more rather that the risks are conceptual ones.
Yeah.
Rather than formal ones.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked about the sequential, you know, collaged prints. That was a huge risk, and then apparently it's not come off
it
too
failed.
Well for most people. So it's risky. You know, well, the whole notion of including things other than the photographs of her friends.
Yeah.
I think what you said earlier about the idea of the juxtapositions being essentially very interesting but banal was at the same time is significant to the extent that that oftentimes the formal resonances between her friends and these great works were just that, sort of interesting and not terribly deep. But the conceptual idea that the whole installation and the show opened up, that that in fact throughout the 1990s and up until today that she's been making these works that she didn't know had precedence in the past, and that she thereafter finds is perhaps the greater upshot of the show rather than kind of the formal gambits of these comparisons, which seem to me oftentimes beautiful but facile in a certain sense. But
so usually when one has an ecstatic experience in an art museum, it would be the sheer otherness of what one's experiencing, and yet it seems perhaps, from to conclude from what you're saying, her ecstasy is, wow,
there's me.
There's me.
Yeah.
Back to narcissism. Yes, at the back, please. Yes. And if you would wait for the mic.
Well, maybe Nan Golden, this is my take. I was thinking that she was saying that all great works of art are contemporary.
All right. I'll buy that. Thank you. I like that idea. Drew, and then we'll move back to the... No, you can't. You can wait for the mic.
I'm just wondering if there's a trend afoot in terms of validation, artists seeking validation or using old masters, not just artists, but critics alike. The recent revelations sort of contextualizing Mapplethorpe within a particularly like classical tradition. You were saying Nan Golden may not have known that she was doing this until recently. Was Mapplethorpe aware that he was doing it? What about Kehinde Wiley and some of the recent paintings mirroring a certain kind of old master poses, and even the recent show at Gagosian of, it was slightly different, of kind of suddenly placing certain artists from the 60s into this context of Russian avant-garde artists, something that I don't think critics or historians would do 20 years ago.
Right.
Well, yeah, I do think you know, some Mapplethorpe's classicism is a very sort of recherché one, and you know, he's a formalist in a certain sense, isn't it? And I think the point of, in some ways, the revelatory aspect for Nan Golden is that her images are these casual, extempore registering of the world around her and her friends, and yet, lo and behold, they happen to, in their casualness and offhandedness, happen to reenact a very carefully and canonically established work. And so I think there is a difference there, that her formalism in that sense was not intentional. It's retroactively intentional, and that therein lies the conceptual premise and frisson of the show, basically.
Right.